You're listening to a 95BFM podcast.
You're tuned into The Wire. 1 hour of current affairs and analysis starting now.
Tēnā koutou katoa, ko Mary Margaret Slack toku ingoa, no mai haere mai ki te wire mō tēnei rā. Kia ora everyone and welcome to The Wire for Tuesday the 21st of August. I'm your host Mary Margaret and I'll be with you for the next hour. I'm also joined in studio by my mates, Ella and Justin. Hello.
Hello.
How are you guys today?
Are you listeners?
Yeah. Text us, we like to hear how you are. Even just a, I'm good. I'm good because this rain makes me happy because I have an excuse to be inside.
Well, hope you guys all have a good day indoors considering the weather out there.
Totally. Coming up on the show today, I speak to Auckland Women's Health Council about a dangerous contraceptive device named Assure and the lack of informed consent in aspects of the health system. Ella speaks to World Vision about the situation in Nauru, which is always a hard thing to learn about, but equally important. Justin's taking us to international news again, and he reports on new infrastructure in Hong Kong. And finally, this week on The Green Desk, we discuss new statistical models which show global temperatures will be staying abnormally high over the next 4 years. Love your climate change.
Great.
I mean, it's been a warm surprised. Winter, so I guess that's one sort of good thing about it. Hey aha or whakaro, get in touch with us with any thoughts that you have. Tuku pātuhi mai, you can text us on 5395 or why am I? Give us a call on 309 3879.
Irirangi Pō, Radio Bosom.
The Wire.
Esha, a contraceptive device designed in the early 2000s, has caused irreversible damage for thousands of women in more recent years. The metal coil is inserted into fallopian tubes, a distinctively more invasive technique than an IUD or rod. As we will soon see, the contraceptive poses very high risks. I spoke to Sue Claridge of the Auckland Women's Health Council about Kiwi and Australian women whose lives have been hurt by the lack of information available about the devices. She started by explaining what the Assure device is.
The Assure device is a form of permanent contraceptive that was introduced as an alternative to tubal ligation. So the advertised benefits of it was that it didn't require general anaesthetic, that it could be inserted in the woman's fallopian tubes in an appropriately trained doctor's rooms that it was minimally invasive in terms of its actual implantation and was a permanent form of sterilisation. So it was licensed in by the FDA in the US, the Food and Drug Administration in the US, in 2002 and was first available in New Zealand in 2003. So it was promoted here as being a viable, cheap, efficient alternative to a tubal ligation. One of the interesting things about this particular device is that in the US, the FDA, some of the FDA panel did express concerns about the small numbers of women in the phase 2 and phase 3 trials of the device, and the particularly the lack of long-term data for Assure. It's a small coil that's probably about 3 or 4 centimetres long, and it's the device. It's made of a number of different materials. It's two what's called micro coils that are inserted into each fallopian tubes, and the coils are made up of a stainless steel inner coil and a nickel titanium or nitinol expanding superelastic outer coil, and wound around the inner stainless steel coil are polyethylene fibres or strings. So, I mean, this is essentially kind of like, you know, the fibres that's in Dacron that you use to stuff, you know, soft furnishings with and so on. So these fibres, they're synthetic polyethylene, and the fibres are wound in and around the inner coil, and they're there for the express purpose of creating irritation and inflammation in the fallopian tubes. Mm-hmm. So that's what they're designed to do. They're designed to provoke a response from the body, an immune and inflammatory response. And to deal with this irritation and inflammation, the body creates scar tissue. So scar tissue is formed in the fallopian tube. The fallopian tube's a tiny little vessel. And so what that scar tissue does is block the fallopian tube over time.
So it's sort of like intentionally swelling it so that it
creating scar tissue. So inflammatory processes are, by and large, they negatively impact on our health. You know, inflammatory processes are the basis of a lot of degenerative and aging diseases and cancer, cardiovascular disease, diabetes. So inflammation in the body is something that we want to avoid. And what they're doing in this particular, with this device, is specifically stimulating an inflammatory process which creates scar tissue. So that's the first issue, that it's actually designed to create an adverse process in the body, an unhealthy process. The second thing is that it's nickel, and nickel is highly allergenic. Some people have existing nickel allergies, and if you're exposed to something and your body responds to it adversely, you can develop a nickel allergy. And nickel allergies have a range of systemic health issues. The device itself, so titanium, we know because we have titanium studs and earrings. We have titanium implants for screws and pins and so on in the body for repairing injury and so on. So titanium is quite inert, but the nickel is not, and neither are the polyethylene fibers. And the other thing is, one of the main problems, the main easily detectable and relatable problems to the Assure device, is the fact that it migrates. So we've got these little pieces of metal in the fallopian tubes, and they migrate out of the fallopian tubes either into the uterus. So we've got sharp bits of metal that start piercing a woman's reproductive organs, or they might migrate outside the fallopian tubes and into the abdomen. So this creates, as you can imagine, a lot of pain. If they migrate into the uterus, it causes a lot of bleeding and cramps and so on. So there's a number of issues. The sheer damage, the Absolutely. Injury that this device causes as it moves around. Mm. One of the stories that's been in the media recently is about a woman who developed really heavy bleeding as a result of the device. She was given a Mirena IUD to try and control the bleeding, and that didn't work. So she was then given a uterine ablation. Now, an ablation is where they use a variety of devices, and it's used, ablation is used to cauterize, like nosebleeds. Basically, it's to cauterize tissue, and ablation is a method that's used in various parts of the body to achieve that. So in the uterus, it's to ablate the endometrium to try and reduce or stop heavy bleeding. But it uses heat. Mm-hmm. So when you apply heat to metal, what happens? It expands. Mm-hmm. And in this case, this woman's case, the Assure, basically the heat caused the Assure device to break apart. Oh, so now she's got shards of metal in her body. Instead of just two single coils that are moving around and causing damage, she's now got bits of metal moving around in her body.
It's just shocking.
It is.
And she also had a reaction to the nickel. I read the story and had face rash, didn't she?
Yeah, face rash, and it can cause autoimmune problems. It can cause systemic things that, systemic autoimmune reactions that cause things like chronic fatigue and headaches and all sorts of things. And so this device in February last year was actually banned in Brazil for these adverse health reasons. It was banned in the European Union, and then in August last year, Bayer. So the original manufacturer was a company called Conceptus, and then it was bought out by Bayer. And I can't remember exactly how long they've been distributing it. But in August last year, they made the decision. There have been a number of things, like the FDA applied a black box warning. Now, a black box warning is when there is a significant issue with the safety profile of a device or a medicine, and they don't pull it from sale, but they have this black box warning on it.
Right.
So they applied that to Assure, but the FDA did come back and say, we believe that the safety profile is okay despite the black box warning, and we're not going to pull it from sale. Bayer withdrew it from every country in the world. They ceased marketing it in August last year and recalled all existing stocks. So it's no longer available in New Zealand, and hasn't been since August last year.
Okay.
Now, whoever thought that it was a good idea to put this inside women's bodies, It's just obscene.
Because you were talking about the FDA and their black boxing process, but my understanding is that medical devices, anything that gets inserted, doesn't have to go through the same level of scrutiny as medicine. So
the it doesn't appear to, no.
Right, so the medical trials that it goes through are insufficient, plus things can get approved based off other things that have been patented. Is that correct?
That's my understanding, that there is far less rigour and scrutiny in terms of the licensing and, well, the trials process and then the licensing. And certainly when, as I said, once it's licensed here, it comes to New Zealand and, it gets accepted here. So MedSafe, they're responsible for regulating medicines and medical devices in New Zealand, and they say that they ensure medicines and medical devices are acceptably safe. So that's what they say on their website. That's up for debate. You know, whose idea of acceptably safe?
Yeah.
So unfortunately, MedSafe relies on the FDA and the European Medicines Agency for their information on whether drugs and medical devices are acceptably safe.
Mm.
And given that we know how closely the FDA works with the pharmaceutical industry and you know, by extension, the medical device industry, and often, I mean, the medical devices are often manufactured by pharmaceutical companies. So to the point where, you know, a lot of people view the FDA being working for the industry rather than for the protection of the public.
Totally.
So because we follow what the FDA does and don't undertake our own kind of testing and so on, it leaves us really vulnerable.
Yeah.
Because we're reliant on the decisions that are made overseas.
So as a council, you do see that as a flawed process?
Yeah, absolutely.
How would you like that to be changed? Is there any sort of way that you have...
Well, so, I mean, certainly, because, you know, this is not the first device in New Zealand which has had major problems. I mean, you're probably aware of the surgical mesh.
Yeah.
And, I mean, that affects thousands more women. In terms of Assure, we're actually lucky that uptake in New Zealand
was
relatively low.
Yeah.
So medical devices must be notified to MedSafe's web-assisted notification of devices, or the WAND database, in order to be legally supplied in New Zealand. But it's not an approval system. It's just a registration system, as far as I understand it. And this doesn't prevent health professionals from importing and implanting cheap medical devices. So they can just register it, and there's no kind of... There seems to be no way of ensuring the quality or the safety of the devices so they can import stuff.
That's terrifying.
Yeah, it is. For most consumers, they are entirely reliant on what their health professional tells them, and they don't know what they don't know.
Yeah.
This is the issue. If you're not given sufficient information, you can't provide informed consent.
Yeah.
The clinical trials are not long-term enough. They do not study or follow up women for long enough to see the adverse events, because they don't happen overnight for most women. They might be months or years down the track before they start having these impacts.
As you say, they don't often follow up with the women sufficiently. Do you think that if there was a male implant, the minute that there had been side effects, it might have been taken off the market?
Oh, absolutely. In fact, I think if you described a device like Assure to a man and said, we're going to put this in your vas deferens and we're going to create scar tissue, this is an alternative to having a vasectomy, it's a permanent form of contraception, and this is what we're going to put inside you, I can't imagine a man being given even half the information about how the device worked and going ahead with it.
Totally.
You know, I just don't think, I absolutely agree that these things would never happen if men were predominantly affected by them.
Yeah.
I don't know, and frankly, the whole thing gives me the heebie-jeebies.
The Wire.
That was Sue Claridge explaining the problems with the Assure contraceptive device. As she mentioned, the device was banned a year ago in New Zealand. Now, the women whose bodies were damaged by it are seeking compensation, but too little support. Our country's ACC scheme prevents them from suing for damages. Women in the same boat in Australia are taking class action, so Kiwi women could join that. However, the lawyers involved are reluctant to allow it. Up next, we're looking into Nauru, so stay tuned. With Pinnacle Life Insurance, your family can hold on to the special bond that keeps you together and tight, even when you're gone. Do it right now. Go to pinnaclelife.co.nz and in just 10 minutes, life insurance sorted. Online, Pinnacle Life. Wake up, Auckland. It's 95BFM Breakfast.
Well, Rick. Let the party begin. Is Rick even there?
Here he is, yeah.
Mikey Havoc, Breakfast.
Hi, Benny.
Hi.
Fashion's so crazy, isn't it?
It is.
Discuss.
Weekday mornings, Breakfast, and a monthly chance to win a year's free internet.
If your song is the one that we choose, then you go in the draw for the UE Boom Wireless Speaker System at the end of the week. Good on you.
95BFM Breakfast with Mikey Havoc.
Woo!
Weekday mornings from 7 till 10, thanks to Orcon Broadband. It's music. BFM, the original originator. Broadcast to the world and podcast to your device on 95bfm.com.
Irirangi Pō, Radio Bosom.
The Wire.
World Vision New Zealand launched a campaign this week calling on Jacinda Ardern to negotiate the resettlement of 119 refugee children and their families to New Zealand at this year's Pacific Island Forum. The children are right now being detained on Nauru, the small island nation in Micronesia, northeast of Australia. Nauru has drawn international attention in recent years due to a humanitarian and health crisis facing the refugees forced to remain on the island while Australia decides their fate. Alice spoke with James Harris, Community Engagement Manager for World Vision New Zealand, who spent time on Nauru working with the refugees. She began by asking him to explain where these kids and families come from and how they ended up there.
There are a whole lot of people from a whole load of countries that have sought protection in Australia. So they've fled from persecution and war, in some cases certain death, from countries like Syria, Somalia, Iran, Iraq, Sudan, just all sorts of conflict zones and hotspots for persecution. Each year, less than 1% of refugees are resettled, which leaves people with little choices. So as we began to see in Europe, we're sort of seen with Australia as well, where people had made their way to Indonesia, mostly, and from Indonesia were taken on little rickety boats to a place called Christmas Island. And Christmas Island is just off the coast of Jakarta, that is Australian territory. So once people get there, they're able to claim asylum in Australia. So in 2013, Australia brought in a law saying if you arrive by boat after July 19th, 2013, you'll never be resettled in Australia. And before, what will happen from then is you'll be taken from Australia to either Manus Island in Papua New Guinea or Nauru, which is the smallest republic in the world besides the Vatican. And you'll be processed there and you'll be detained there until you're settled in a third country. So far the only third countries are Cambodia, who has paid $55 million to settle seven refugees, which is nuts. Yeah. And there was a deal done with Obama to settle up to 1,250 refugees from Nauru and Manus Island. So far, under 200 have gone, but it's obviously now hindered by the travel ban that President Trump has brought in. Mm. So anyone from Iran, Syria, Somalia, Yemen, and a bunch of other countries will never be included in that deal. So it's moving at a glacial pace at this point.
You spent a few years there, is that correct?
Yeah, so I was in Nauru from 2012 to 2014. I was there firstly with the Salvation Army and then moved over to Save the Children. Both the organisations were outspokenly opposed to what was happening, but said if the refugees are going to be there, then we want to be on the ground with them, caring for them. Mm. So the majority of the time I was with Save the Children as a youth worker, working with 30 unaccompanied minors. So they'd come from Afghanistan, Iran, there was Rohingyas from Myanmar, and Tamils from Sri Lanka, and they'd had to flee, but they'd left without a parent or a guardian. So my role was sort of as a youth worker supporting them as they were in detention in such a crazy circumstance.
Wow, they were, how young were they?
All of them were 15 and 16 at the time.
Wow, and they were by themselves.
Yeah, really strong, resilient young men. They were all guys, but it was extremely, extremely tough.
Yeah, what is life like for them? Where do they? What is daily life like? Where do they get food, and what do they do? And
so when I was in Nauru, when the first family started arriving, so at that time, everyone was in, they had what they called like offshore processing center three, where they were housed. And the middle of, so Nauru as a country was mined for phosphate, tiny little rockets, 21 square kilometers. Mm. So the entire middle of the country is sort of a desolate mine. Mm. And in the middle of the mine is where the processing centers were, or the detention centers. So it's a desolate landscape with very, very little plant life. Like, everything was sort of gravel, and people lived in sort of big white marquee tents, and there'd usually be about six families to a tent. So it'd be little, probably sort of three, four square meters per family, separated by wood and tarpaulins. And they weren't able to leave the detention center at that point. So life was really simple. Food was provided at the detention center. There were English lessons for the adults, and there was a school run by Save the Children for the kids. It took time, but people began to be found to be refugees. And as that happened, people were slowly moved to sort of compounds in Nauru where they had a bit more freedom of movement, but there's not a lot for anyone to do. So I think a lot of people pass time trying not to lose their sanity, but it's pretty hard in a situation like that.
Do they have access to any kind of resources to pass the time, or?
There's not a whole lot available. There are, you know, some people still play sport. For those that are free, they can, that know how to, they can swim, which is amazing. I had a few moments where, there's that scene in Shawshank Redemption, I'm not sure if you've seen it,
yeah,
where they're sitting on the rooftop and drinking beers because they've just, you know, helped with that guy's accounts or whatever it was. And he's like, for a moment, we forgot where we were. And that was one of the things that was beautiful, being able to go swimming a couple of times with some of the guys, that for a moment you could see they'd forgotten where they were. So there are, in amongst the harrowing circumstance, it's people, and people are beautiful and resilient. So there are those moments of beauty and resilience in amongst it, but it's really tough. But in terms of, yeah, things to do, there's really not a whole lot, to be honest.
Do they interact with the local, how would you say it, Nauruans?
Yeah, they do, and the Nauruan people are amazing, but there was no consultation with their government, and between their government and the local people, for the detention centre opening. So it's a bizarre circumstance where you have a local population of around 10,000 people in 21 square kilometres, and now there's close to 1,000 refugees. So it's the local people didn't ask to be there. So in a weird way, they've sort of been colonized by refugees who don't want to be there. So there's tension at times because the local Nauruans are proud of Nauru, and they should be, but you have 1,000 people saying this place isn't good enough, I don't want to be here. So there's tension, and there's definitely tension there. Just after I left for the last time, the unaccompanied minors had just been moved. So the young guys that I worked with, they had just been moved from the detention centre to a house in the community. And I saw in the news the week after that two of them were put in hospital by locals who confronted them for being Muslim and beat them up. So, yeah, it's definitely not as unsafe as the community in Papua New Guinea where the men in Manus Island are. But it's definitely not the ideal situation.
Do you understand what the agreement between the Australian government and Nauru?
Yeah, so I don't know all the details of it, but yeah, so this first happened under the Howard government in Australia. So it started in 2001 and went to 2008, and then started again in 2012. One of the things that's problematic is that it's essentially the national industry now is detaining refugees. Nauru itself, there's not major industries, so it's they're sort of stuck. So I don't know, the details. One of the things that was announced was that anyone that wouldn't be accepted in the US deal would potentially just be given a 20-year visa for Nauru. Initially, what happened was the Cambodia deal was really being pushed, but people had to sign to say that they would go. But a lot of people didn't sign for the Cambodia deal because Cambodia once was paid off by China, because Cambodia is a signatory to the Refugee Convention. So they do have refugees that go there, and there were a group of refugees from China who had gone, that I think were political dissidents, and the Cambodian government was paid by the Chinese government to round them up and put them on a plane and send them home, which happened. So I think because of their treatment of refugees in the past, people didn't want to sign the deal. And so what they did at that stage was they're like, okay, well, they extended the length of everyone's visas for Nauru so that people thought, oh, if Cambodia is the only option, then potentially we'll be able to go to Australia. But that didn't seem to work out.
What is the Pacific Islands Forum?
So the Pacific Islands Forum happens annually. This is the 49th annual Pacific Islands Forum coming up in just a couple of weeks. So it's a chance for leaders from all the Pacific nations and Australasia to come together in a different country each time and to discuss regional cooperation and economics and how we can best work together. Things like climate change have come up at the forum in the past. Yeah, so this year it is being hosted by Nauru. So it's happening from September 3rd to 6th. And Jacinda Ardern confirmed yesterday that she'll be attending.
And does she have the power to bring them to New Zealand?
It has to be accepted either by the Nauruan government or the Australian government. So the offer's been put on the table for us to take 150 refugees from either Nauru, Manus Island and Papua New Guinea. It was first offered by John Key and was turned down, and then it was offered again by Jacinda Ardern when she first met Malcolm Turnbull, and again it was turned down. The second time it was turned down, they said it was on the grounds that they would consider our offer once the deal with the United States to resettle up to 1,250 people was completed. But we know, however, that that's hindered by Trump's travel ban. So a large majority of those people won't be able to be considered in the US deal. That's why World Vision is calling on Jacinda Ardern at the forum to offer to immediately take all 119 children and their families to New Zealand, because we can't wait around for the US deal, particularly because of the travel ban.
And that is possible for that to happen.
It is possible, and there's the precedent of New Zealand under Clark's leadership taking the people from the Tampa boat who weren't let into Australia, were taken to Nauru and then brought to New Zealand. So we've done it before, we can do it again.
Do you know if there are Australian NGOs that are pressuring their government to do something similar during this forum?
Yes, the same time that we launched the campaign, World Vision Australia launched a similar campaign under the same name of Kids Off Nauru. So their call was that Australia would resettle all children and their families to safe third countries or bring them to Australia by Universal Children's Day, which is November 20th. So that was led by World Vision Australia, but 30 other organisations came in behind it. So it's a coalition of NGOs making that call in Australia.
Is there anything, if people are listening to this and feel compelled to do something, is there anything individuals can do to put pressure on or raise awareness, or what do you suggest?
Yeah, people can visit wvnz.org.nz/kidsoffnauru. When you're there, you can read more about the situation and also see a video by a guy called Abbas Nazari. Abbas Nazari came to New Zealand as a child from the Tampa boat that was sent to Nauru and then was settled in New Zealand. So he has a call directly to Jacinda Ardern there. But also from that website, you can send Jacinda Ardern a Facebook message. And it's important right now that she's hearing our voice, the voice of the people saying we want the kids off Nauru. So yeah, you can head to that address and make your voice heard.
Is there anything else you want to add?
A story that sticks out for me from my time in Nauru was quite often I would have young people sort of that I would be chatting to, and it would come up that I was Kiwi. And quite often the refugees being detained by Australia seemed they loved New Zealand. One girl once said to me that she was beginning to learn Te Reo Māori from some of the security guards. And I just remember it so clearly with the
detention centre fencers like towering over us who are like looking at me and saying kia kaha, which is, you know, be strong, be brave. That's sort of my message for Jacinda Ardern and for New Zealand in this time, that kia kaha, like we can do this, like we can be strong and brave and stand up to injustice.
Why should New Zealanders care so much about this?
Because your children will curse you if you don't.
The Wire.
Ko te Wire, tēnei marunga BFM, you are on The Wire on 95BFM. In our next story, what are we looking into, Justin?
Well, today's international story, I'm looking into a couple of Hong Kong infrastructures. There are two of them. One is a bridge and a railway connecting Hong Kong with China. And yeah, in my clip, I'm just going to find out what the divisions are and how they affect the city, because I'm from there.
Cool.
In the next 4 months, two of Hong Kong's most controversial infrastructure projects will start operations: the Hong Kong-Zhuhai-Macau Bridge and the Hong Kong Express Rail Link. Both projects are expensive and in some ways unpopular with different parts of the city. First, I'm starting with the bridge. Consisted of a three-cable state bridge, three artificial islands, and an undersea tunnel, it is the longest in its type. The governments of Hong Kong, Macau, and China are supportive of the projects because of the long-term economic benefits it can bring, as ABC's Bill Bertless reports.
The Pearl River Delta is home to roughly 60 million people. If the densely populated cities around this waterway were combined, it would be the world's biggest metropolis. And that's the long-term thinking from China's government in linking Hong Kong to Zhuhai and Macau.
The bridge will act like a ring road for the Pearl River Delta area. It will not only speed up transport, it will also help spread Hong Kong's development to the cities on the mainland side.
One criticism is the cost of the whole project, which critics describe being it as a, quote, financial black hole. When the project was first announced in 2009, the Hong Kong government estimated it will cost 506 million Hong Kong dollars and the bridge will be open in 2016. However, fast forward to 2017, the government had delayed the opening date to late 2018. And the total cost had added up 237 times to 120 billion Hong Kong dollars. That means each Hong Kong citizen will need to pay 16,000 Hong Kong dollars, which is 3,000 New Zealand dollars, for the project. Also, just in April, questions are raised about the structure on one of the project's artificial islands. Here's Radio Television Hong Kong's The Pulse.
The aerial photographs posted on the internet show that a number of interlocking concrete blocks, known as stolices, at the edge of the eastern artificial island appear to have become displaced. The blocks are meant to absorb the impacts of strong waves and protect the island and tunnel. In one set of images taken at low tide, the stolices are scattered above water. At high tide, they are submerged. The images sparked an outcry. Representatives of the Hong Kong-Zhuhai-Macau Bridge Authority, including officials from the three governments, argued that the stolices are actually designed specifically to be submerged in a random manner. Those stacked at the side of the island that rise above the water's surface are there to absorb the force of the waves. Others are there to prevent vessels from sailing too close and damaging the undersea tunnel.
In the same program, Albert Lai, the founding chairman of public policy think tank Professional Commons, explained how does the scattered or submerged blocks cause problems to the island's structure.
Because at high tide you can see that all these stolos at the tip of the island have been submerged. Now, everyone knows that if you really want these stolos to be effective, it has to be above the waterline so that when the wave comes in, you know, it breaks all the energy and so on. So if a normal day, a normal high tide day, all these stolos already submerged, then how can this, you know, be functioning as a kind of wave-breaking structure?
On the other three sides, there isn't that gap. So maybe it's the case that the rest of it holds up the weaker part of the structure.
No, not, well, not at all. I mean, you can see that the waves will come in all directions, obviously. And that if you have the waves hitting this wall, this concrete wall, all the time, obviously it will be under undue pressure.
But the next project I'm going to talk about, the Hong Kong Express Rail Link, is even more controversial, as its details raised concerns about Hong Kong's autonomy under Chinese rule. The Hong Kong Express Rail Link is the Hong Kong section of the Guangzhou-Shenzhen-Hong Kong Rail Link, which is part of the Chinese rail network. The railway starts at West Kowloon Station in Hong Kong and terminates at Guangzhou South Station in China. The Hong Kong government is supportive of the plan, with then Secretary of Transport and Housing Eva Zhang claiming the railway can connect Hong Kong with other Chinese cities and provide economic benefits for all. Since the railway's proposal in 2009, it has been subjected to intense opposition. In fact, after the first funds for the railway were approved by Hong Kong's Legislative Council in January 2010, Zhang and other lawmakers who support the project had to leave the building using public transport instead of cars, as the roads are blockaded by protesters. Here's a news report from Now TV.
外界示威者围困咗喺立法会五个几钟头嘅官员同议员喺呢个时候就由几百个警员护送离开立法会大楼。
Like the Hong Kong Zhuhai Macau Bridge, its cost had inflated from an estimated 669 million Hong Kong dollars in October 2009 to $844 million last May. The completion has also been delayed twice, from the initial estimation in 2015 to late 2017, then to next month. However, the biggest controversy is the co-location arrangement at Hong Kong's West Kowloon Station, which stations Chinese immigration officers in a, quote, mainland port area, which is a part of the station leased to China. In this area, Chinese officers can exercise their full jurisdiction. That means part of Hong Kong's territory will be using Chinese law. To understand why the agreement is so controversial, we need to go back to 1985, when the Sino-British Joint Declaration was signed between Britain and China regarding Hong Kong's future in July 1997. Under the agreement, China promised a one-country, two-systems principle, which Hong Kong will be part of China, but the Chinese political systems and policies will not be practiced, and the current way of life shall remain for 50 years. This is recorded in Article 18 of Hong Kong's de facto constitution, the Basic Law. Supporters of the agreement believe it can save travelling time, as passengers do not need to stop at a checkpoint at the Hong Kong-Chinese border to clear customs and immigration. Here's Hong Wing Tat, a fellow at the Hong Kong Society for Transportation Studies.
I mean, how can you make full use of the high-speed rail? It is a speed. So how can you get through the customs, both customs, faster than the current arrangement?
The government also believes the arrangement is acting accordingly to Article 18 of the Basic Law. This is Rimsky-Yun, then the Hong Kong Secretary for Justice, speaking last December.
What Article 18 of the Basic Law stipulates is the extension and application of national laws in the entire Hong Kong SAR. As regards the application of national law in the West Kowloon Station mainland port area, their scope of application is only confined to the mainland port area.
However, scholars raised that the arrangement might have violated Article 18 as well as other articles in the Basic Law. Eric Zhang, principal lecturer of the University of Hong Kong's Law Faculty, told Radio Television Hong Kong last December.
Article 18 of the Basic Law makes it clear that within Hong Kong, we only apply Hong Kong law, with the only exception of national laws which are listed in Annex 3. Article 19 makes it clear that Hong Kong courts shall have jurisdiction over all cases in Hong Kong. Article 22 makes it very clear that mainland officials or personnel stationed in Hong Kong must abide by Hong Kong law.
Alvin Yang, a lawmaker from the Civic Party, is also one of those who opposes the agreement.
Look at it from the political point of view. Mm. We have the Basic Law. We have one country, two systems. And these are the backbones of Hong Kong. And we can't compromise our principles for the sake of convenience.
Critics are also worried that the co-location arrangement will become a Trojan horse, which gives pro-Beijing politicians the mandate to introduce legislation that limits Hong Kong's freedom of speech or assembly. In an opinion piece to the New York Times, former chief editor of the Hong Kong Economic Journal, Joseph Lien, believes the arrangement will, quote, finally break the resolve of local Democrats and pave the way for more political encroachment from China in the future, most likely under the Basic Law's notorious Article 23. Article 23 of the Basic Law states the Hong Kong government should enact laws to safeguard national security, including banning organizations. However, it does not have a general legal mechanism defining what should be banned. The Hong Kong government once attempted to push through the implementation of Article 23 in 2003, but the bill was shelved after 500,000 people protested in the streets. The legacy of these two projects is long-lasting, as it partly started the first wave of localism in Hong Kong during the early 2010s. Prior to 2009, the Chinese identity in Hong Kong is stronger than before, contributed by the compassion for the Sichuan earthquakes and the feeling of prestige brought from the Beijing Olympics in 2008. However, these sacrifices brought by the two projects, such as the destruction of dolphin habitats for the bridge and a 40-year-old village for the express link, have raised awareness to preserve local heritage as well as the traditional way of life from the interests of a small minority of economic elite. The protests against the projects also helped develop a new generation of left-wing democracy activists. During that time, protests are led by university students who are born during the 1980s when Hong Kong experienced an economic boom. Well-educated and possessing an affluent upbringing, they are fully committed to changing the society. Apart from students, the protests also inspired those who were born in the 1990s, including Joshua Wong, one of the student leaders during the 2014 Occupy movement. He once said, quote, Joshua Wong would not become an activist should the protest against the express rail link did not happen. Hong Kong has experienced many infrastructure projects in its history, but both the Hong Kong Zhuhai Macau Bridge and the Express Rail Link has impacted the city like no other, as it changed how future Hong Kong generations think of the bureaucracy, especially China forever. Yeah, and that's for my sound clip today on these two projects. Just one thing I haven't mentioned in the clip. The Hong Kong Express Rail Link will be commencing operations on the 23rd of next month. Yeah, so if you have any opinions on my piece, especially on these two projects, just give us a call or text. What's the number, Mary Margaret?
It is 5395 for the text and 309-3879 for the call.
Yeah, so if you're either from Hong Kong or want to comprehend my piece, yeah, do text in. Or if you're from other places and want to say I have been bribed by the Americans to say this, yeah, do let me know.
Divisive issue, eh? It's interesting.
It's very divisive.
I think sometimes people think of infrastructure as apolitical, but it is very
political, yeah. Especially in Hong Kong, but
right.
That's, I think, for all the infrastructures around the world, whether it's an airport,
yeah,
or a bridge or a new
even
railway.
A public,
it's always
bench
political.
And the way it's designed.
Yeah,
how well can we want people to feel in public spaces? Anyway, it's all very interesting stuff. We'll be back after the break.
Happy birthday, baby. You're the most beautiful bubba a mother could ask for. You're always here. You don't ever have to go away. And you won't run off with your tennis instructor, will you, baby? No, you'll never leave. Oh, it makes me sick how much I love you. You'll never leave. Not like them. Never.
Devoted to your pets? 95BFM's Heavy Petting is here to answer all of your veterinary queries with help from the friendly folks at Pet Doctors. Heavy Petting, thanks to Pet Doctors. Every second Tuesday, only on 95BFM Drive!
A group of emperor penguins huddled close, moving together in synchronized waves. This is Universal Harmony.
Radiating togetherness with positive energy. This is Universal Harmony.
As wholesome
wholesome as fresh sliced sourdough and as empowering as winning a prize at school assembly. This is Universal Harmony.
Tuesday nights from 10 till midnight are reserved for Universal Harmony with Dr. Snickers, only on 95 BFM. Putting the bubble back in your moe. That's Universal Harmony.
Kia tau te rangi marie, o rangi nui e tui honei, o papu tuanuku e takatonei, o te tai ao e awhinei I a tātou, tihei Māori ora. This is The Green Desk on 95 BFM.
Recent statistical models are showing global temperatures will be remaining sky high until at least 2022. My Green Desk reporter Jack Marshall had a chat with Professor James Rennick from Victoria University School of Geography, Environment and Earth Sciences. Professor Rennick gave us the lowdown on how these high temperatures will affect us here and abroad over the coming years.
What I really want to know is that with these statistical maps, so often they're so hard to predict what's happening in the future. How is this like so sure of its results?
They're not saying for sure that it will be warmer for the next 5 years, but they're saying, you know, if you had to bet on it, it would be better to bet on it being warmer rather than cooler. So, yeah, on the balance of probabilities, what they're saying is the next 5 years are likely to be similar to the last 3 or 4 years, which have been unusually warm.
What kind of weather events will we see, like in a general sense, going forward then?
Well, yeah, it's hard to be precise about a particular place like New Zealand or any location around the world. What this piece of work is saying is that global temperatures are likely to stay pretty high. I mean, temperatures have been going up for a century and more, and we're now a bit more than a degree warmer than the pre-industrial value. So the whole globe is considerably warmer than it used to be, and that trend is continuing while we continue to put greenhouse gases into the atmosphere. So you can't say exactly where, but it's likely that the sort of weather that's been seen, the sort of events that have been seen in the Northern Hemisphere this northern summer, you know, the fires, the drought, the heat waves, all that kind of thing, are pretty likely to recur around the world over the next few years. But, you know, which places are affected and when, we're just going to have to wait and see, I would say. But one thing that's pretty obvious is that while we continue to let the climate warm up by continuing to release greenhouse gases into the atmosphere, all of these kind of extreme events are just going to become more and more and more common.
I think it's hard because not just as journalists, but as the general public, we kind of always want those clear-cut answers from, you know, scientists. We want to know where it's going to happen, what it's going to happen.
Well, okay, yeah, I mean, for 30 years, the climate sciences community has been saying, yep, the climate is warming up and there's going to be a global catastrophe if we don't deal with it. I mean, I think that's pretty clear.
Mm.
We're talking about the global economy going down the tubes and hundreds of millions of people being affected, and that's been the message from the climate community for decades now. I don't know how much clearer you could make it.
Mm.
And really, there's been no action so far. So, you know, what can I say?
Yeah.
The science hasn't changed for a long time. The National Academy of Sciences in the US put out a report in the late 1970s, 40 years ago, that essentially said all of these things. And that was tabled with the US government. And it looked as though, actually, in the beginning of the 80s, that the US might actually move on all of this. But then, what do you know, the oil industry swung into action and
money
muddied the waters. Yeah, I mean, there's a huge amount of money tied up in the status quo and in burning fossil fuels. And a lot of that money's been used to delay action. I mean, it's been a real disinformation campaign. Yeah, bad news. And we still have time to avoid the worst, but time really is running out.
Mm. Yeah, well, thankfully Victoria University has divested, but we're still waiting on Auckland. That's another story.
Yeah.
And then so I think more locally I'm just thinking with the, you know, all these massive fires going all around the Northern Hemisphere, do you think we'll see weather events like that this summer in New Zealand, just because it's been happening everywhere over the Northern Hemisphere? Do we have the kind of climate like that here?
Well, It could happen, yeah. I mean, we had big fires on the Port Hills outside Christchurch, not the summer just gone, but the one before that. And, yeah, that's the outlook for New Zealand too, that as the climate warms up, as the east coast of the South Island or both islands dry out more, the chance of forest fires goes up dramatically. So, you know, I can't guarantee there will be dramatic forest fires in New Zealand next summer, and I actually hope there won't be. But as time goes on, the risk of those kinds of events happening here is increasing. So, yeah, if not this coming summer, then in due course, you know, in the next few years, I would expect we would have some kind of forest fire events, as well as, you know, droughts and heat waves and all the rest of it. Yeah, New Zealand is not immune from any of this stuff.
Mm. And I think, on an unfortunately, like more pessimistic kind of note, it seems that with all the climate kind of models going forward and not a lot of change happening, it really does seem like we're kind of just locked in to get a lot hotter over the next kind of century, really, aren't we?
Well, if past history over the last few decades is anything to go by, yeah, if we just keep going in the same direction, yep, you're absolutely right that we might see 3 or 4 degrees of warming this century. And, yeah, I mean, that ultimately would be catastrophic globally. Hmm. We'd be talking about several metres of sea level rise, you know, huge changes in rainfall and extreme temperatures.
Yeah,
and agriculture, you know, food security going through the floor, all sorts of things, yeah.
Yeah, because I read that in these kind of, like, newer papers coming out, saying these figures, like, 3 metres rather than, I used to be reading, like, 3 foot, and now it's 3 metres. That's, like, that's wild.
Yeah, well, yes, it sure is. I mean, it depends on, if you're talking about this century, we're not looking at, you know, 2 metres at the absolute outside, I think. But down the track, we might be talking about 30 metres or 60 metres. You know, if it warms up enough, then all of the ice in Antarctica melts and we get 70 metres of sea level rise. I mean, that would take time, you know, it would take hundreds of years to melt that much ice, but we can get to a point where it can't be stopped, and that could happen in the next 50 years. So, yeah, we could totally redraw the coastlines of the world over the next few decades if we choose to do nothing about greenhouse gas emissions.
So that's totally not ideal, and message to all the kids out there.
Totally not ideal, that would be a good way of putting it.
Yeah, yeah, message to the people out there, can we just help stop this, please? Cause
yeah. Yes, please, policymakers, business leaders, everybody, do your bit. That's what we need, yeah.
Don't use plastic bags.
Well, that's another story, but yep, that would help too, absolutely.
That was The Green Desk on 95 BFM. Tihe Modi Order.
That was The Wire.
That was indeed The Wire for another Tuesday. Thanks to my producers, Jack, Justin, Ella, Jackson and Absentia. But I've got my friends here.
Yay.
Good well, Wire. You. Thanks, everyone.
Have a very great day, listeners.
Yeah, totally. And also thank you to those who came on the show. We had Sue Claridge, James Harris and James Rennick. 2 Jameses. Yeah, who'd have thought?
Good day for James.
Thank you to all of you for tuning in. I'm leaving you today with Wasting Time by Princess Chelsea. Up next is The Wonderful with Jin. Have a wonderful week.
95 BFM presents Princess Chelsea live, October 26th and 20th. That was a 95 BFM podcast. To hear more, head to 95bfm.com/bcasts.